Accession number 17129, Reel 4.
But I think that probably you haven't got time.
Well, I mean, fairly broad. I noticed that was it. The F3 had a larger fin. I mean, you enlarged the fins on all the later.
That's lines, right. During the development of the Lightning, we realised that the basic aeroplane had adequate control and stability with its initial stage one. Fin. The first fin was too small, and that had been discovered before we even flew. So the aeroplane was limited in relation to that. But there was a stage one fin, which was to increase the fin area, I think, by about 15%. That was all right for the Mark 1 Lightning, but when we got on to red top missiles, which were bigger than the initial Firestreak missiles, which were hung outside under the nose, it was realised that the aeroplane would be limited directionally, and it was decided to have a stage 2 fin increase, which was the one that you've seen on the Mark 3 Lightnings and the Mark 5 Lightnings and all subsequent ones. That was to increase the fin area by, in fact, deepening it and squaring the top. Yes, I flew the first of those on a development Lightning XG310 in about 1959, and it provided a clear improvement in feel. It wasn't expected to, but it actually made it a slightly crisper aeroplane directionally, and they all had that big fin after that.
Was it about this time that you went to America again to fly the Century fighters?
Yeah. As a result, I think, of the success of the P-1 Lightning program, the ministry said, look, we've heard about all this stuff coming from English Electric, but we'd like to know how it compares with the latest that the Americans are doing in the Century series, the F-100, 102, 104, 106. These were all aeroplanes of great potential that were coming along in America, and somewhat surprisingly to me, I was told off to go to America and fly them, and this was a unique opportunity. This was in 1958 or maybe 7, can't be quite precise, but we'd done enough flying on the P-1B version of the Lightning to know that it was an enormous success in performance and in handling quality, and so going to fly the American equivalents was going to give me a direct comparison, and I went over to Muroc Dry Lake, or Edwards as it's now called, and I first started flying the F-102, a TF-102, which was a trainer version of the
The Delta Dart, wasn't it?
Yes, I'm trying to remember the manufacturers.
General Dynamics.
General Dynamics, right. Yes. The TF-102 was a side-by-side trainer version of that, and I was given a checkout on that by a USAF test pilot, who's a very nice chap whose name escapes me, and I did two flights in that until he signed me off as being capable, and then I flew a 102, which was the single-seater version of this, and I found it a very, very pleasant, likeable aeroplane, virtually subsonic. It was rather a Javelin characteristic aeroplane. It would just about get to Mark 1, but if you pulled any manoeuvres, it was rapidly subsonic. But a nice aeroplane, and it would do what it was supposed to do. It was an all-weather fighter, and it did very well. I then went on to fly the 104, which was right in the height of its development difficulties. At the time I arrived there, 19 test pilots had been killed in it, in the program, and it wasn't going to end there. It was a very sharp little airplane, very heavily wing-loaded. You're aware of it, of course, very, very, very small, very thin wing, knife-edge wing. And it was very critical in all sorts of aspects. I was briefed that the engine development was in a bad way, and the throttle shouldn't be moved at high Mach number except very, very carefully to avoid flame out. I said, well, what do you do if it flames out? And he said, well, you won't be able to relight it. So I said, what do you do then? They said, well, you glide it back to overhead Edwards, and if you're at 15,000 feet overhead Edwards with no engine running, you point it downwind, you keep it at 180 knots, and you execute a 360 degree turn. At the end of that, you'll be at around 2,000 feet, and if you're not pointing at the runway, you bail out. So I said, well, that sounds fairly easy. And he said, well, it isn't actually, because if you're at 2,000 feet, you're really rather too low to bail out on the ejection seat system, because it's a downward ejection. And all of this was very encouraging. Anyway, I went out to fly this airplane, and then I was stopped and told there was an emergency, and I looked out to the south side of the aerodrome, was a long column of smoke, and the test pilot who had briefed me on the high incidents, characteristics of the aeroplane, Dave Holloman, had been killed on the approach when his engine flamed out and he was too low to eject. He's now got an airbase named after him, Holloman Air Force Base. Cut a long story short, I then flew two sorties on 104s, and on my second sortie got it out to Mach 2, which is the first time the first time I'd been to Mach 2 in anything, because we hadn't got the Lightning quite there by then. And it was an interesting, exciting experience, but it was very, very limited operationally. It was poor manoeuvrability, very, very critical in a number of ways, and I was really quite relieved not to have to fly it again. Before they finished the development of that aeroplane, they lost 23 pilots killed in testing it, and before the end of the program, the US Air Force cancelled its order for over 1,104, saying it's unsuited to the Air Force requirement, and they retained one wing for experience purposes, and they never used it operationally. But they mounted an enormous international campaign to export the airplane. They got this great production going on, and nowhere to send them. And so they supported an enormous worldwide campaign of exports, headed up with two Globemasters, one Globemaster carrying a 104 with its wings off and that sort of thing, and the other Globemaster carrying a full technical crew headed up by an Air Force general. And they went round the world with a tremendous sales campaign, probably unprecedented, and they sold it, as you know, to a very large number of air forces, many of whom I think regretted it afterwards. Then we went on from there to fly a very interesting aeroplane, the F-106, which was the major development of the F-102 Delta, and called the Delta Dagger. And that was an uprated Delta Dart or F-102, bigger engine, and I was given a good briefing all of one morning on this aeroplane, allowed to fly it in the afternoon, and that was the end of it. So I wasn't able to get an awful lot out of it, but in that time I found that it was an aeroplane that handled very like the Lightning. At that stage it wasn't as fast as the Lightning because they were having engine development problems, but I thought that once they got it right, it would probably be superior to the Lightning in one respect only, and that it had a more advanced weapon system, which has always been the Achilles heel of our developments in this country in the fighter field, because our weapon system radars have always lagged behind. Probably they don't now, but they did in those days. And so I came home reporting that the F-106 was the best of the bunch and was probably a better overall all-weather fighter than the Lightning, but that it wasn't as fast and it wasn't as manoeuvrable.
That was an aircraft built to police the Dew Line, wasn't it?
That's it.
It had a long loiter capability.
That's right, and they kept it in the States as a home defence aeroplane. Basically, they didn't export it at all. But it was a very fine aeroplane in its time, very good.
Now, I remember reading your account of your Mark II flight over the Irish Sea and the Lightning, and it was pretty fuel critical, wasn't it?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Now, you then went on to fit a large ventral tank to the aeroplane.
Right,
engine,
yeah.
To make it give it more endurance.
The Air Force always made that classic observation of the Lightning, that it was a bloody marvellous fighter in which the fuel crisis began at takeoff. yes, the Lightning was designed for point defence of the V-bomber bases. Nobody could ever understand this specification, but that's what it was designed for. And in order to get maximum time to altitude, maximum acceleration, the fuel capacity was just tailored to that. It just had enough fuel to take an aeroplane off, fly at 150 miles on a supersonic climb, intercept and glide back to base. That meant that for everything, any other job than that, it was going to be very restricted. Well, we all realised that this was quite rubbish, and that if it was going to be perform a normal flexible fighter role, it needed, I recommended in writing, that it needed twice the internal fuel capacity. Eventually, by 1959, we were developing that, and for the Mark 6, Mark 2A, the Mark 53 and 55, all had this long extended under-fuselage tank, which was a very clever device. It put in, I think it was something like 9,000 pounds more fuel without seriously affecting the drag or aerodynamics of the aeroplane. It was designed according to the aerial rule, so that it fitted just into that part of the aircraft where it could be accommodated without putting the drag up. And that increased the loiter capacity and the general flexibility of the aeroplane enormously. And the Mark 6 in Air Force service, of course, then became, until the arrival of Phantoms, it became the standard long-range interceptor on the northern approaches. They used to go off from Binbrook and then tank right up to the Faroes and beyond with reasonable flexibility.
Now, about 1957, Duncan Sands made his notorious remark that there was no future for the man fighter. Now, this was slap bang in the middle of the Lightning program.
That's right, yes.
I mean, you met the gentleman, obviously. I've got a picture of you standing with him.
Oh, many times.
Yes.
Many times.
I mean, what were your opinions of him? Well, be repeated?
I was going to preface this by saying that most of them are unrepeatable. I had a lot of experience of Duncan Sands, and for what it's worth, I regard him as a failed politician. But he was a man of very great bias, and he'd make a decision based on not properly researched facts, and whatever anybody said to him after that, he'd stay with that opinion. He made this extraordinary decision as the minister concerned in 57 to cancel the development of supersonic aeroplanes after the Lightning. There would be no requirement for supersonic aircraft in the RAF after the Lightning. All defence requirements would be met by missiles. Well, this of course cut out the human flexibility from decision making and for defence planning or anything. If you followed that, you'd got to put every strategic target throughout the United Kingdom, you've got to surround it with missile sites and missile radars, which would have been an impossible proposition. Anyway, he did it, and then 2 years later, that decision was turned over by the establishment of the requirement for the TSR-2, which was going to be a supersonic bomber. But that was just one of those very, very rocky decisions. If I can expand on that a little bit, I made comments about Duncan Sands and his bias. In 1944, on Newchurch, Dungeness, I was involved in operating this wing of Tempest against the V-1 flying bombs, and we were the leading unit in the defences. We, at the time I'm talking about, we'd scored about 600. We shot down about 600 in 6 weeks. And as the a minister, he wasn't a minister at the time, he was Churchill's appointed investigator into the defence against the flying bomb. And he came to visit Newchurch to see us, and we showed him what was going on. And during the course of it, there was an attack on a V-1 right overhead by one of my Tempests, and we dived into the ditch as it exploded. And when we got up and dusted ourselves off, Duncan Sands looked at his watch, said, well, time I should go. And I was just about to usher him into his car, and he said, you know, you people are wasting your time. All this sort of thing will be done by rockets in the future. That was in 1944. And he said exactly the same thing again in 1957. And that is the sort of thing that went on, I think.
Now, another minister, of course, was Julian Amery, who was not only minister, air minister, but also the local MP for Wharton, wasn't he?
Yes.
He was a more sympathetic character.
Great supporter, yeah. Great supporter. Great patriot. He was driven by patriotism, by the need to continue to defend this country as it's always been defended. You could say he was one-track minded, but in the process he was involved in supporting us in our activities in trying to produce a bomber for the Royal Air Force to the specification that had been produced by the air staff. He was totally unwavering on that, and he was certainly a very good friend to us.
He was in the Macmillan government, wasn't he?
Yes.
Of course, he was Macmillan's son-in-law.
Yes, yes.
That was about the early 60s, wasn't it? 63. So
that's right, yes.
TSR2 started.
That's right. He came up to Wharton to commiserate with us. Not to commiserate with us, to celebrate our the first flight. Came up and gave a dinner. Very nice of him. No, he was very supportive, and he did his best to save the programme, but nobody could do that. Not the way it went. I think the programme would have been saved if Hume had stayed PM, if the Tories had stayed in power. I think that although there was a great attack going on, much of it was badly argued. The cost-effectiveness was the argument that was used against it. But they hadn't realised at that time that the change from subsonic military aviation to supersonic military aviation was going to up the costs of defence, you know, by an order of magnitude. You can't get it for free. Previously, I mean, generation, decade after decade, military aeroplanes had gone up by 50 miles an hour at the most, increase in speed. But to get an aeroplane to go from the subsonic regime to the supersonic regime, you've got to overcome this vertical drag rise that occurs with the compressibility of air from 80% of the speed of sound up to the speed of sound. That costs money. And that's what we were up against.
Equivalent cost rise.
That's right. Yeah. And people didn't realise that then. But if you look, we're now onto TSR2, aren't we?
Yes.
If you look at that programme, we're now in 1996. If the TSR2 had gone into service, even late, if it had gone into service by 1975, which it should have done, or even earlier, in the early 70s, it would still be in service today. It would have been past a midlife update. It would have had all its electronics and avionics and weapon systems updated to the latest state of the art, because it was a big aeroplane. There was plenty of room for changes of equipment, and of course with the vast advances of micro technology, they're all getting smaller.
Yeah,
and
you had a huge equipment bay.
You had a big aeroplane, and I've had people argue this, and they say, "Well, there you are, total waste of time. You didn't need an aeroplane that big." But what you do is, as you develop micro technology and you make the equipment smaller, you fill all the empty space with fuel, make the aeroplane more flexible. It would have been an aeroplane. We'll put it on another context. If you had it in service today, it would have been an aeroplane that had a considerably longer unrefueled range than a Tornado. It would have done the Tornado's tactical work with the same CEP, the same attack accuracy as is required for the Tornado, with terrain following radar and all the rest of it. It would have done it at the same potential target speed, low level, and it would have had a 2.5 Mach capability at altitude, which is faster than the Tornado, and that's 30 years later. It was a tremendous breakthrough, and nobody could say, you know, when it was cancelled, nobody could say, well, it will actually do what it was intended to do. But in 24 flights, we achieved such an incredible confirmation of its capabilities that we, the people who were on the job, could see no reason, no argument against it being perpetuated. We thought this airplane is actually going to do what it's intended to do. Nobody knew what the weapon system would do, but if you had the vehicle to carry the weapon system, it was only a matter of time before you got a decent weapon system for it.
You see, I've come across this tremendous conspiracy against the TSR-2 more recently, as a book being just published on it.
Mm-hmm.
That I read, that the scenario goes that McNamara wanted to promote the F-111.
Yes.
And the TSR-2 was a big competitor.
Yes.
And when the Wilson government came in 1964, there was the usual financial crisis, and as a payment for bailing the Brits out, the TSR-2 had to be cancelled. Am I sort of reading your thoughts as well? Or?
Oh, absolutely. We've always believed that, but you'll never bottom that particular argument. I mean, people dodge out from right, left, and centre. If you go and talk to the big names who were involved at the time, they look down their noses and they don't want to pursue the argument. There was something very shady going on behind that.
You see, I was interviewing Dave Morgan in the summer, and he was at Weybridge.
Yes, he was.
At the time of the cancellation.
Yes, he was.
And I mean, they were talking about putting another proposal up, you know, a Spey-engined Mirage 4.
That's right, yes.
But he said, you know, can we get out the existing aircraft and line them up and photograph them?
Yeah.
No.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
You know, even the production jigs were zealously destroyed. I mean,
that's
it does sound as if that was a hell of a price that government paid.
We have photographs, well, I say we, British Aerospace has photographs, which it's very coy about, showing enormous conflagrations going on outside number 2 hangar at Samlesbury, where these production airframes were dragged out, stuck into a pile on the grass by the perimeter track, and set fire to, and all the magnesium in them going up, you know, like a bomb. And they were being set fire to by the operatives who built the bloody thing. I mean, the whole thing was really malign. It was quite extraordinary. But against that, you see, we were just the simple operatives, the engineers and technicians and the air crews and so on, and we could see that this thing we'd been striving with for nearly 10 years was so far from being a technical failure, it was a positive and a very great technical success. And it would have provided the Air Force with a unique power, you know, for the last 30 years, which it hasn't had. People often ask me about what it would have done in the Falklands. Well, it would have done a hell of a lot more in the Falklands than we were able to do there. I mean, we, with a great deal of enormous administrative organisation and a lot of agony and a certain amount of straightforward courage, we got a couple of Vulcans out from this country all the way down to the South Atlantic to drop a stick of bombs across Stanley Runway, which the calculations said would create two craters out of, what, 20 bombs. And it did. What did that prove? I mean, the Arkies went and filled the craters in and went on flying. The TSR-2 would have gone out there with flight refueling, and it would have had a weapon system which would have ensured that we knocked out Stanley on the first strike. And then they could have gone on doing it, too.
You see, the terrible irony of all this is that the way was cleared for the F-111, which in turn proved to be a flop.
Well, this was the thing that drove people like myself up the wall, because being in the business, we keep an eye on what other people are doing. I mean, we have a jolly good idea what the Americans were doing with their Century series fighters while we were developing the Lightning. In the same way with the TSR-2, we had a very good technical idea of how they were going with the F-111. And all our best brains at Wharton were saying in the summer of 1965, summer of 1964 rather, when we started to first fly the TSR-2, that the F-111 is going to run into immense technical problems. They will solve them, but it'll cost money. The program is going to overrun costs by an enormous amount, and it's going to overrun time by so much that it will probably make it politically unviable. Well, all that happened, but the Wilson government came in and they said, right, we'll cancel TSR-2 and we'll look after the Air Force by ordering the F-111 instead. And there were many, many people, I'm sure people like Murray and Morgan were advising them not to do that, because they'd lose their shirts. And then 2 years later, they lost their shirts because the F-111 program was going out of sight in terms of time and cost escalation. And so they cancelled and paid cancellation charges and ended up with nothing at all. I mean, it's a disaster, isn't it?
Of course, there were so many other... I mean, Peter Twist was telling me the same sort of story with the FD-2.
Yes.
When he went down to Bordeaux to do some supersonic flying there.
Mm.
And when it was hangared at the local base,
yes,
down there, the Dassault engineers were crawling all over it, and a few years later the Mirage comes out.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's, I mean, the development of the FD-2, I think...
Right. Well, the concept, absolutely, yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. And, of course, the other side of that story, which Peter Twist may have told you, is that, totally unlike our government, the French have positively and very heavily supported their industry. For all the years since they came back into the business after World War II, they've supported them in all sorts of ways. I mean, they support the first production run. Then they would support exports by if they could get a government interested in buying Mirages, they'd say, right, you can have 12 Mirages from our 4th Escadrille or something. They can go straight out there, and then our squadrons could be repaced from the production line as and when they could be built. Not in this country. No concessions at all. And, there's never any help from the government directed towards the military section of aviation, as far as I can see. Dreadful.
Because there are so many. I mean, there was a book I read, Project Cancelled, and my view of the aircraft industry is not as an insider at all, but as a reader.
Mm.
And they bring out the story of the Saunders Roe SR-53.
Yes.
Which was another one. I mean, that was a casualty of SANS, of course, isn't it?
Yes, it was. Yeah. That's Derek Wood, yes. Wood. He's made a life study of that.
Was it, I mean, the design of the TSR-2, I mean, that was carried out all at Wharton, or was something done down at Weybridge?
No, it was a combined operation. I'm not particularly sympathetic to the way it was done. The government decided that, having decided to reverse its decision about supersonic aircraft for the Air Force, it was going to have a supersonic reconnaissance bomber. But this would be, in its judgment, too great a task for any one company, and it would only be undertaken on the basis of two of the strongest companies in the industry amalgamating, combining for the contract, together with a third company to produce the engine. There was a lot of resistance to that idea, but this was the only contract that was available in the military field, and it had to be considered that way. And so eventually, after a lot of discussion in industry, Vickers and English Electric went together into the consortium to be called BAC. They jointly recommended a Rolls-Royce engine, The ministry said no. In their view, the Bristol Olympus was in a better state of development, and that's what was going to happen. So Bristol's came into the consortium with the Olympus. The Olympus turned out to be not a development engine, but an entirely new engine with enormous troubles, which delayed first flight and made it a bit hazardous. That's another story. But as far as the design is concerned, having granted the contract dependent on English Electric and Vickers to combine, they said that the project would be managed by Vickers under Sir George Edwards, and that the design point, that is where the design started, was to be the English Electric P-17, which was a specific design for this particular aeroplane. That was a built-in source of friction right from the start. Vickers were going to manage a project to build an English Electric design. The English Electric would say, well, why the bloody hell can't we do it ourselves? And that sort of friction had to be overcome. It was overcome. A maximum effort by the people concerned, which was wholly admirable, got these two organisations together. So eventually you had a system whereby there was a fairly equal division of responsibilities. But basically the answer to your first simple question is the aerodynamics of TSR2 was largely done by English Electric at Wharton. The avionics, which was the other vital part of the operation, was done by Vickers. I'm trying to remember the name of the chap, an awfully good man. And
Harry Zeffert.
Harry Zeffert, that's right. Marvellous chap. And he got it right, too. The undercarriage, of which the least said the better, was done at Vickers. And various... the cockpit was a Vickers design. But it was an even split.